Wisconsin Public Radio is committed to a diverse schedule of news, music, talk, and entertainment programs. Member support is the single biggest piece of our funding. It makes all the Wisconsin Public Radio programs you enjoy possible. Donate today at WPR.org. Phil, you published Days with My Father a few years ago, but it's still immensely popular. And it got, I know, a huge response when the photos first began appearing online. Were you surprised by how strongly people reacted?
I was totally surprised. I mean, I remember very clearly thinking to myself when I was taking photographs or writing about my dad that it was such an extraordinarily personal project for me that there was no way that anyone else would be interested in it. And I couldn't have been more wrong.
What kind of responses surprised you most or affected you most strongly?
Well, the most surprising thing, I think, was that probably a good half of the emails came from kids. Teenagers, really. And what they were talking about, because Days with My Father is not really a book about death. It's a love letter from me to my father.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book about our last few years together. But it's also a book about love. And I think that that's what they saw in it, because so many of them wrote to me and said, this has made me think about my parents more. This has made me think about my grandparents more and how I should value them while they're here. And that was a real surprise and, frankly, a real privilege for me.
So it's not hard to see why so many people would have a heartfelt response to the photos. They're so tender. I mean, I don't know what you do as a photographer to make your love for your subject palpable, but it really is in these. How did you do that?
It's funny. I get emails all the time from students asking for tips. They say, oh, I'm doing a project. I was really inspired by the thing with your father. I wanted to take pictures of my grandparents. And do you have any tips? And my only response to that is that you have to, two things really. You have to be naked, not literally, when you're taking the pictures. You have to be, that would be awkward. You have to be totally unabashed about showing your heart. And you have to not think of it as a project. You have to think of it as... And the way I thought of that work was I was taking photographs for myself. I was recording something for myself. And when you think of it that way, you're not ashamed or embarrassed about what you're recording. And the other thing I think most importantly was that I took very few pictures, really, when I was doing this work. I didn't want the process of taking photographs to overwhelm just being with my dad. So I would take, you know... 5 or 6 pictures or 7 or 8 pictures, and he'd go, okay, that's enough. I'd put the camera down. And sometimes I wouldn't take pictures for a couple of weeks. But there were specific things I wanted to remember.
Like what?
Well, there's one photograph in the book where I talk about his ambition and his ambition for me. And his ambition for me was one of the few things that was left for him that really brought him unalloyed joy. So I wanted to remember what his face was like when I told him I'd done something good. I'd sort of, you know, shot for a magazine he would know, or done an ad job, or whatever it happened to be. And I wanted to remember that, so I sort of made that picture happen.
Your dad was 96 years old when your mom died and you took on his care. And he had short-term memory problems also. So what was the photographic process like between the two of you? Did he enjoy it?
It's interesting because he was an actor in the late 20s and early 30s.
Oh, yeah, he'd been on film, right?
Yeah, he was in movies and he was on Broadway, had a pretty good career on Broadway. And so I found all his clippings and press shots and headshots and the whole... I mean, it's kind of amazing. So he understood how to be in front of the camera.
Maybe he loved it then. Maybe this was really fun.
Well, I think, two things. I think he liked the idea of being in front of the camera. And he liked the idea of what I was doing. And when he'd say to me, what are you doing? And I'd say, well, I'm doing this. I'm taking photographs of our life together. And he'd say, oh, I like that. And then he'd say, let me see the pictures. And I'd show them to him on the iPhone. And then he would look at them and go, these are terrible, which is hilarious. But it occurred to me the reason he thought in part they were terrible, well, a couple of things. One is because he was very used to an idea of formality in photography, the idea of a studio shot, of a shot where he looked beautiful and handsome. And the idea of being 96 or 97 and looking frail was surprising and unappealing in some ways to him.
I think I remember in one of your little text bits, didn't you say your father was kind of vain? That he always he wanted to look his best.
He was always meticulous in how he dressed. I grew up with my father as an artist, and we'd go to his gallery openings, and he'd be in the jacket and have a little cravat and the whole business. I mean, it was old fashioned style from the 30s or 40s. And he was a very, very handsome man when he was younger. And I think that left a mark, so that he always felt that he wanted to look good. I mean, there was one time I was trying to get him out the door to the doctor's, and he was in his wheelchair. And there was a mirror on the way to the elevator. And I remember going past the elevator, going, thinking to myself, please don't look in the mirror, please don't look in the mirror. And he looks in the mirror and goes, wait a minute, because my father was American. He said, wait a minute, we've got to go back inside. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, I've got to dye my hair with a black pencil. And I said, what are you talking about? And I said, what do you think? You think there's like a flock of, you know, eager young ladies outside anticipating your entrance, your departure. And he didn't think that was funny. But I couldn't get him out to the doctor. So, but that's part of the thing is I think that my feeling about the reason why people had the reaction they did to the work is because a lot of the work I've seen is so unremittingly sad about that particular stage of life. And I think that I just happened to be lucky in the way my father and I lived those last few years together. And there's, of course, sadness in there, but there's also everything else that makes up life, which is beauty and strangeness and humor and you know, heartbreak and all the rest of it.
How did your dad himself feel about his own physical changes and physical deterioration? Because I think that's so hard for all of us living in a culture that is, well, you've worked in advertising and you take photographs for magazines. You know the kind of youth and beauty culture we live in. And if that was important to your dad, how did he feel about the physical changes?
Well, my father was always... he was always someone. I grew up with my father eating whole grains and bran for breakfast and swimming. And then every morning I'd see him in his underpants doing calisthenics in the living room. I mean, he was way ahead of his time. So he was always about fitness. He used to read this book. He spoke French, and this book was always by his bedside called Restez Jeune, which means stay young. And it was a book. It was this old book from like the 30s on yellowed, crumbly paper, but it was sort of like a Bible for him.
This is a guy who really wanted to live.
I don't think he ever really understood that he was 97 or 98. I mean, we used to have this joke. He'd say, how old am I? And I'd say, how old do you think you are? And he'd go, I don't know, 22 and a half. With a sort of little glint in his eye. And I go, yeah, you know, more or less around that age. I think more than anything, it was the idea of living in this peculiar twilight where he was unsure of what was happening that was hard for him.
Yeah, because he had short-term memory loss.
Yeah, he had no memory of my mother dying, no memory of me taking her to hospital or going to her funeral. So for the first 3 or 4 months, he would say to me, "Where's your mother?" And I would say to him, "Well, don't you remember? We went to her funeral and she died." And he'd look at me in total shock and say, "What do you mean? What? When did this happen? Why was I not told?" And that would happen every day, every hour, for weeks and weeks. And it was unbearable for both of us. So I sort of invented a fiction that we both lived within to make that more bearable.
You told him your mother was away on a shopping trip in Paris?
Well, initially I thought to myself, I'll say she's just gone out to the shops. But then I realized that would not be a very good strategy because, you know, she'd presumably be coming back at some point. So I said that she had gone to Paris to take care of her brother who was sick. Mm. And that became this kind of fiction this delusion that we lived within for 3 years. And I think that he knew the truth. And I think that was one of his last acts as my father, was to participate in this charade with me for both of us.
How did your relationship change as he became more dependent on you? I mean, at a certain point, it must have started to feel like you were the parent and he was the child.
Oh, of course. Yeah, very much so. And often he was a recalcitrant, petulant child.
But how was? I mean, is that that's the thing we always fear? I mean, it's both on both ends, right? Parents fear and do not want to become dependent on their children, and children don't want to become the parents of Children do not want to become the parents of their parents.
Right. Well, that was not that. That wasn't easy. That was the easy thing for me to rationalize or to justify, because it occurred to me very early on that they'd had the decency to take care of me when I couldn't take care of myself. So the least I could do is return the favor. And then, of course, there was food. I mean, basically, towards the end, he really kind of only ate eggs. And I remember having a very funny conversation with the doctor. Went to the doctor and I said, I'm kind of concerned about his cholesterol levels because he eats raw eggs with orange juice, egg drop soup, omelets. That's all he eats. And the doctor said, listen, he's 97 or 98. I don't think his cholesterol levels really matter at this point. And I went, oh, yeah, that's an excellent point, doctor.
Well, that's one of the most heartbreaking photos for me in the book is that picture of your father. He's upset about eating. I think he's crying.
Boy, he was mad. He didn't like it. And then I got mad because I'd made this dinner for him. And I just remember wasting so much food at the beginning because I was always trying to make stuff that my mother had made for him. And of course, I'm a disastrous cook, so it was not very good. And, you know, I'd make this big meal and he'd go, this is no good. But it was the unvarnished truth. And there was no sort of taking into account that I'd tried to make a meal for him. So eventually I remember that he liked egg drop soup from the Chinese restaurant around the corner. But the trick was that I had to say that I'd made it. So his chair was kind of facing the door.
So you'd have to sneak the egg drop soup in.
Well, yeah, the delivery guy would show up and then my dad would go, who is that? And I go, oh, it's just someone from the building checking. And then I have to sort of hide the egg drop soup under my sweater and get it into this kitchen. And then I pour it out and bring it out to him. And then he'd look at me and go, is this homemade? And I go, yeah, yeah, I just made it.
Yes, homemade in the home in down the block.
Exactly, by other people.
Well, you started publishing these or putting some of these photos up online when your dad was still alive, right?
Yeah.
Once you started getting feedback from other people, the project itself must have changed and the way you thought about it must have begun to change.
Well, I waited a year before I started taking photographs and then I started posting, I guess, when I was really almost done with the whole thing. And people ask me why I put it up on the web, and I think in some ways I'm an only child, and even though I could talk to my wife about it, I think that it was a very solitary experience for me. And I think it was sort of a form of, and this is going to sound peculiar, but a form of exorcism. It was a way of, it was such a thing for me to carry on my own that I just wanted to, get it outside of myself. And when I travel to give talks about my work to places, I go to Finland or England or France or wherever, people would say, how's your dad? And I thought that was really beautiful. I think that I'm an artist and most of the art I do is pretty useless. And I think that goes for most art in some regard. But I accidentally did something that was useful. So if I shuffle off tomorrow, I've done one good thing and I'm happy about that.
But do you think working on this, and especially, you know, as you continued to work on it after he had died, was working on it a form of mourning, do you think? I mean, a way to do something with your grief?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, it's a way of having a conversation with myself, of making sense with it all. I mean, actually, that particular body of work really changed the course of the river in terms of the work I do now. And I'm doing something about my family now that's been hidden for the last 40 years. So I discovered a way of talking to myself, of making sense of things with myself. It was a form of language, I guess, that I discovered. So,
what do you mean? Can you say more about that?
I created a language that I can talk about with myself to make sense of things that are really, really overwhelming, like the death of your parents or the imminent death of your father. It gave me so much to do that work, and it's given me the courage to do something I'm working on now, actually. I had a sister who died when I was a kid, and she was 9 and I was 6, and it was never spoken about again, really, in my family. And then when my father died, I found this box of stuff that my mother had collected, all neatly arranged in envelopes of basically a sort of a whole record of my sister's life, of clothes and toys and letters she wrote and books she read and awards she received and photographs. And I think that when your parents die, they leave you with boxes within yourself that you can choose to open or not. And having done the work about my father, I chose to open that box literally and metaphorically to do with my sister and to find out who she was. And because I have no memories of what my life really after her death. And that's what I'm working on now. And it's been extraordinarily hard because it's something that's so buried. But it's been extraordinarily beautiful, and I feel grateful that I can have this discussion with myself.
There's a documentary film you did called A Shadow Remains. Is that part of what you're talking about? What is the shadow?
Well, I think that when your parents die, the shadow they cast remains within you, and you see that shadow for the very first time after they're gone, and you understand what they've left you. You understand the things, the gifts they gave you. And it takes a few years to understand those things, but I'm so eternally grateful for what they've given me. I feel so lucky.
What do you mean it takes a few years to realize? Like, what kind of things have you discovered after your parents' death that you didn't realize or didn't notice before?
It's so hard to quantify. It's the way that I think about certain things. It's understanding their generosity that they gave to me, their openness in seeing the world that they gave to me, their elasticity in their thinking that they, I think, hopefully gave to me, and the love that they gave to me, and the ability to see the love and to want that in others, to want to give that to others. These are all things that they gave to me and made me who I am, and they're all things that I became very sharply aware of after, in their absence, I suppose.
You were talking about how doing this project changed the way you photograph or the kinds of projects you want to work on. I mean, you also, I think your day job still is taking photographs for magazines, working on assignment, correct?
Well,
or not?
Not
you moved
really
away
anymore.
From that?
Well, it's funny because I've only been a photographer for 10 or 12 years, and I started off being a photographer, not knowing what I really wanted to be a photographer of. But I always knew that art was very important to me, so I always made books, I always had shows, I always made art. But since the death of my parents, I've realized that I'm happy to, I like doing that stuff and I still do that stuff, but art is the thing for me. And, you know, look, the terrible thing about death is that you realize that all cliches are true. So one of the great cliches of death is you realize how important the time is that you have. And, you know, I have a peculiar form of rationalizing, of making decisions. I think of myself in the future looking back. So when I think of myself, and that's how I decided to become a photographer. So when I think of myself at 60 looking back, will I be proud that I decided at 45 or 42 to really focus on art, or would I be happy that I decided I just wanted to take pictures for magazines? And the answer is very clear when I look at it that way.
Don't I remember, didn't you? Wasn't there some project you were doing? I read about it. I haven't seen it. Taking pictures of yourself as you think you'll look at some of different ages?
Well, the photographs of my father spawned a series of projects, one of which is, and the working title is called Confrontations, but I can't decide whether it's just horrifying or really, really good. Part of me feels like it's slightly horrifying. But there's a photograph I took in Days with My Father. I had got a movie that my father was in 1931. It was a Charlie Chan movie. And in that film, he's 25 or 26. And I'd never seen my father that young. When I was born, my dad was 58. So to see your father young and strong and fluid and with a clear voice and athletic was really extraordinary to me, because it occurred to me when I was watching this movie with my dad that everything that I knew about my father hadn't really happened to him yet. This whole future was this enormous expanse before him. So I started thinking about that. But I also became very apprehensive about my own future. Look, mm-hmm. I've had such a privileged, lucky life. I've been given everything. I've been so fortunate in so many ways. And when you have that kind of life, you always assume that your life is going to be on an upward ascent, that you will, things are always going to go the way you think they're going to go. And when my mom died so suddenly, it made me apprehensive about the future. I just didn't envision that this is how my life would be. Suddenly my mom would be gone and I'd be taking care of my father until he died. And I just hadn't foreseen that. So I became very worried about the future, my future. So I decided I was going to do a project that would somehow try and anticipate all the darkest possible turns that life would have in store for me. It's a project about the future, so how do you research the future? Because photography is always about the past. So I took a DNA test that told me what illnesses I was likely to get. And then I talked to fortune tellers, tarot card readers, palm readers, numerologists, all these people who predict the future. And I'd say to them, I know it all sounds a bit crazy, and I'd say to them, okay, you know, tell me about my future, but in particular, if you can...
Do your worst.
Yeah, basically, yeah, exactly. Do your worst. What's the worst possible thing you see for my future? And then I worked with a prosthetics person who would make me up with silicone prosthetics to look like a version of myself. So then, and I also took acting lessons to learn how to move as a man in his 90s or a very obese man in his 50s.
You really went all out.
It's not about photography, because I'm not even taking the pictures anymore. My assistants are taking the pictures. It's a performance piece, really. But also it was been a form of exorcism, and it's been incredible to do that work and to know what it's like to be 92 in a wheelchair being pushed around by a nurse, and to know what it's like to have people not look at you, to be invisible because you're a person at the end of their life. I know what that feels like a little bit now.
And has that changed you?
Yeah, it's made me unafraid.
Really?
Yeah, because I know what I'm going to look like. I know all the possible, I know the worst possible outcomes. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty others that life has in store for me.
You know, a way of going, oh, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure all the bad things, that, you know, there'll be something else. But I know what, it's extraordinary to be 92 and then 45 again in the same day. Yeah. No one gets to do that, really.
Well, that's, I think, the other thing we didn't really talk about in terms of your project and part of my theory about part of why it struck such a nerve. I mean, for all the reasons that we talked about, and because the photographs are so beautiful and so filled with love, but also because not only do we not handle and not talk about end of life very much in this culture, we're terrified of it, and we also don't see it, right?
Right, that's right.
And I think when you face something you're afraid of, almost always, you know, talking in cliches, almost always it's not as scary as you thought it would be. The fear is worse than the thing itself.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and that was a big part of doing this project Confrontations, by making the intangible tangible. It's not frightening anymore because it's comprehensible. It's understandable. You know, you have a sense of what it's like.
And I wonder whether, I guess I think that's part of why people respond so powerfully to the photographs of your dad, both because, you know, we're all scared of facing the end of life, either our own or somebody we love. The photographs you took make living with your dad at the end of his life look not so bad, you know.
Right.
You know, sure.
Well, look, this is the thing I say about that. You're, first of all, we all have a choice in how we say goodbye to our parents. And secondly, I was just lucky because my father didn't have full-blown dementia. He had, you know, he had some a form of dementia, but he knew who I was most of the time. He wasn't angry most of the time. You know, we had beautiful moments together, and some people don't have that luxury. But I did. But you're right. I mean, I guess that's the I think you're quite right. I think that it shows that it may, if it does anything, it shows that it doesn't have to be unremittingly sad if you want it not to be.
And the other thing is it showed that living with somebody like your father with dementia in his late 90s, with his body deteriorating, didn't look so bad. But it also doesn't look so terrible to be your dad either.
Well, it's hard to say, actually. I remember my father would often talk about wanting to go. He'd said, I remember, you know, he said, oh, I want to go. And he said, I said, well, look, the problem is you've exercised your whole life, so you're too fit. And he'd go, well, next time around, I'm staying in bed. It was kind of hilarious. You know, and, but he really wanted to go. And it, and because other than me, there wasn't anything for him. So I don't know. I mean, I'm a real fan, and this is going to sound weird, but I think that euthanasia or whatever it's called is should be a real. I think that's something that we should be talking about because I know that my dad didn't want to be here anymore, and this is a very strange thing to say, but and it's quite a hard thing for me to say because when he'd say he'd wanted to go, it would so heartbreaking for me because the voice inside me would say, "But don't you want to be with your son?"
Yeah.
Sorry, I get very emotional when I think about that. But at the same time, I used to have this peculiar idea about, you know, suffocating him in his sleep because it would be the thing he'd wanted, you know, because he didn't want to be around really anymore without my mom. But then again, of course, that just seemed crazy as a son to be thinking that.
Well, that's how complicated and huge those emotions get, you know?
Right.
Did your family talk about death much?
No, I think because of my sister.
Oh, right, that's right.
We never really spoke about it. I mean, my mom and I talked about the disappearing, but the assumption was, I mean, partly the shock was so great when my mom died because that's not the way it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be my dad would die first because he was 18 years older than my mother, and then my mom and I would have 10 or 15 years together, where she would get to meet her granddaughter and all the rest of it, which never happened. So, you know, that wasn't how it was supposed to be. And that's kind of one of the things I think that precipitated that the Confrontations Project is that life is often not how it's supposed to be.
Phil, thanks so much for talking today. It was really lovely.
Thank you so much. It's been amazing.